You're listening to Extension 720. Milt Rosenberg is away tonight, so we're bringing you this previously recorded interview with James the Amazing Randi, one of the world's leading magicians and psychic fraud investigators, and author of the book, The Mask of Nostradamus, a biography of the world's most famous prophet.
Welcome, Amazing.
Always good to be here, Milton.
It's been 7 or 8 months, I think, since the last visit.
At least.
Now, what was that prophecy you read to me a moment ago? Because you didn't really make it up whole out of your own invention.
No.
It is a Nostradamian prophecy.
It is indeed. It's from Century 1. It's number 38 in Century 1. And I only read 2 lines of it. I didn't think your audience could bear all 4 lines, but it's typical of the
kind
of thing.
Well, these are done in quatrains, 4 lines, so give us the 4 lines again.
Okay. Now, this is not my translation of it. I'm looking at the French here, and I really didn't attempt. I just took this man's particular translation of it. The book I'm looking at is over 320 years old.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first English edition of Nostradamus. I bought it at great expense and carry it every place I go, just in case I need a quick prophecy. So you can throw open the book and get a prophecy for today at 4 o'clock. It says, "The sun and the eagle shall appear to the victorious. A vain answer shall be made good to the vanquished. By no means arms shall not be stopped. Vengeance maketh peace. By death he then accomplisheth it."
The man saw far and clear. What exactly is he talking about there?
I think there's an eagle near the sun or something. It's really interesting that, of course, you can take this. You can make Donald Duck and Donald Trump out of the same line if you try hard enough. And that really is what my book decided. In the long run, after you've read the entire book, you have to close it and say, well, I guess the conclusion is that people can make anything out of anything. And that's exactly what they do. They take, they'll take anagrams, for example. That's one of their favorite things. And it is true that Nostradamus did actually use anagrams to disguise names, but only when he was talking about people that lived in his day, like Henry II, who was his king at that time in Provence, in France, where he was born and lived his life.
Now, let's make it very clear. There must be 10 people in the audience who've never heard the name Nostradamus. In fact, there must be more, because earlier tonight, before I met you for dinner, I went over to Ricardo's restaurant, to the bar, where I sometimes sit, sipping a mineral water.
Frequently, yes.
But only sipping a Perrier or something.
Sure.
And chatting with friends. And some people I didn't know were just getting up from the bar, and the woman in the group saw I was carrying a book, and she said, "Oh, what is that book?" And so I showed it to her, and she said, "Well, now, who is Nostradamus?" And I said, "Surely you've heard of Nostradamus." And she literally hadn't heard of Nostradamus. And she said, and when I told her that he was one of the great prophets of all time, or so he was credited to be, though that in this book that view of him is viewed skeptically and is analyzed in a way which tends to suggest that ambiguity and flummery will get you pretty far in the prophecy game, she thought it interesting, but she still knew nothing about either Nostradamus or, forgive me, James Randi.
What?
I was more amazed by that, even than that she didn't know about Nostradamus. So, for the 10 people out there, including that lady, who promised she would listen tonight, better make clear just who Nostradamus was and what his significance is, and why we should be interested in him at this late date, since he lived 400 years ago.
He was born in 1503 in Saint-Rémy de Provence in the southern part of France. At that time, Provence was not part of France. It shortly thereafter was given to France and became part of the country, and therefore came under the rule of Paris. Henry II was Nostradamus's king, and Catherine de Medici was the queen. She was a lady, if you were requested by her to give her your right hand, you cut it off immediately and handed it to her with the left, because she was not a lady to be trifled with. Well, first of all, he became a physician. He studied as a physician. He was from a moderately well-to-do family. His father was a notary. And he studied to be a physician, graduated at an early age from the University of Montpellier. And
should I interrupt to claim a tribal connection, though he was a surface Catholic and maybe secretly a Protestant? In fact, he was of Jewish derivation, wasn't he?
Yeah, his family was. Pierre de Nostradam, his grandfather, had taken that name, changed from Guy Gassonnet, because they were a family of Jewish notaries, and the family history invented by his son César, his eldest son, Nostradamus's eldest son, was somewhat more glorious than the family actually was. The family were very honest people. They were grain dealers, but he had them as poets and scholars and all physicians and such, and very powerful people in the community. They were hardly that, but they were moderately well-to-do, and therefore he could, his father, Jacques, could afford to send him to Montpellier, which was not an inexpensive thing any more than it is today.
And there he learned medicine in the style of the 16th century, which involved a good deal of astrology and necromancy, as well as working from the volumes of Galen and maybe Avicenna.
Avicenna, oh yes. In fact, Montpellier, the whole system of medicine there was based on Avicenna's findings. And actually, the mysterious thing is, and I really didn't point it out in the book because it didn't really become obvious to me until later, in Montpellier they specialized in surgery. Now, surgery was not looked upon as medicine, because surgery was mostly amputations. They didn't fix up bones or anything. They chopped the whole thing off.
It was usually done by barbers, I believe.
Well, there were surgeons as well, but they were on an equivalent with barbers and such.
Yeah.
They were mechanics more than physicians, you see. But still, they had to know astrology. They had to study astrology first. That was an absolute requisite, along with Latin, of course, so they could read Galen and Avicenna and the rest of them. Now, in understanding astrology, you would think, what could a physician use that for? Well, in 16th century medicine, as it was at that time, was very, very primitive, of course. And it was, well, Paracelsus, Theophrastus Bombastus, etc., etc.
Theophrastus Bombastus von Hohenheim, otherwise known as Paracelsus.
Watch your language.
One of the greatest names in Western history, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. And one of the most disliked men of his day, because he was a pompous ass. There's no other way to describe him. But nonetheless, he did contribute a great deal. Until he came along, medicine didn't really take anything on anything at all, like what we are familiar with today. But astrology was necessary, they thought, because it was a configuration of the planets and the stars and the sun and the moon among them, which dictated, along with those configurations at the birth time of the victim of whatever ailment it might be, that would dictate both the diagnosis and the medicine that would be prescribed for use.
And all of that, then, is the sort of world into which Nostradamus comes. Michel de Nostradamus, even while still a medical student, goes off and works, apparently with some heroism, to try to help those victimized by the bubonic plague.
That's right.
The Black Death, so to speak.
Black Death, which actually was three different plagues,
yeah.
One of which was bubonic.
And he comes back to medical school and so on, and he also has aspirations to be a writer. Once he gets out of medical school, the first book he writes, strangely, is a treatise on cosmetics.
Cosmetics, and also in the same book, this is interesting, not only cosmetics and perfumes, which are very popular with the ladies who didn't change their clothes for 6 or 8 months at a time, so, you know, perfume would help your love life at least, or at least your social life, let's say. And in the same book, he also has recipes for jams and jellies.
Yeah.
So he threw everything into the same
didn't
book.
Didn't he do another cookbook?
And a telephone directory, too, incidentally, at the end.
It's not and another cookbook later on.
Another cookbook later on.
And then suddenly he starts producing The Centuries.
Well, he had,
which
at the same time,
his,
been playing
his
around...
His book of prophecies.
Yeah. At the same time, he'd been playing around with almanacs, however.
Mm-hmm.
And almanacs are yearly prognostications based upon... They're
just
not like we think of it, the farmer's
just
almanac.
Just like, well, the farmer's almanac is yearly prognostication.
Indeed, it
about
is.
Weather, at least.
Yeah, about weather and such that's going to prevail. And, of course, we know how accurate it is. And not very. It's about as accurate as Gene Dixon, for example, which is not very accurate. Now, the interesting thing, I think, was that he found out that he was very successful at this. Now, the book on condiments and whatnot, and flavorings, and jams and jellies, and makeup, that sold well enough, I guess, because there are still copies of it around. But printing had only been introduced something like 35 years before, remember, in that part of France. So it was a new discovery to him.
But now we come to The Centuries, which is the great prophetic book of Nostradamus, and he did it in various groupings. Centuries doesn't refer to the centuries chronologically.
Right.
It refers to 100 quatrains.
That's right.
Which makes up a century,
a
hundred.
Right. A group of 100.
Four-line poetic
that's right.
Verses. And the total number of centuries is...
10.
10. But it doesn't quite come to 1,000. It comes to 900.
Oh, some of them are... Pardon me, I need a physician from the 16th century.
I could have predicted that.
It turns out that there are some quatrains missing. He didn't finish all of the centuries for some reason or other. And different editions of Nostradamus have some other quatrains tacked on the end, which may or may not be authentic.
Now, Nostradamus, for the last 300 years, or maybe for the last 400 years, has been viewed as a man of miraculous prophetic powers who could see the future and predict the future with unerring and devastating accuracy.
That's a lovely redundancy, predict the future. Did you notice?
Well, no, you could also not predict the future.
Well, that's true, too.
You could also confound the future or misunderstand the future.
Or miss altogether.
Yeah. And he's been celebrated by 1,000 commentators who are all Nostradamians. One of the best known, though maybe it was just because he lent his potent voice to the project and didn't really care and didn't believe, was Orson Welles.
In the most rented video of all time.
Still the most rented video.
Still the most rented.
In which Welles points up which great predictions?
That's not including Abbott and Costello Meet the Stewardesses, which is a different field altogether. No, the Orson Welles tape on The Man Who Saw Tomorrow, it was very interesting. It was based upon one of the books, or several of the books, by Erica Cheatham, an elderly lady who has written extensively on this subject. Her last three books were something like...
Cheatham, you said?
Cheatham, yes.
We just had some linguists here last week talking about names and naming. There's a category called aptonyms, people who are well-named for what they do. Dr. Frank Slaughter was a surgeon, for example. And you tell me a Mrs. Cheatham?
Erica Cheatham, yes.
Yeah, well, interesting.
I never thought of that connection, but now that you mention it, I better look into it. Or Fulham might have been a better name. But Erica Cheatham, her last three books are something like The Last Prophecies of Nostradamus, then The Very Last Prophecies of Nostradamus, and The Final Prophecies of Nostradamus. I doubt she can follow that.
Still to come should be The Hidden Books or The Hidden Centuries of Nostradamus.
The Undiscovered Last Prophecies of Nostradamus, the ones he never wrote.
Now, in that film, which I've seen, that Welles narrates, he makes particular claims about four or five major predictions.
Right. Well, the interesting thing is that I must sort of save Orson's reputation to a certain extent.
Yeah.
If you watch that tape carefully, he continually disavows any belief in Nostradamus. He says, now, I don't personally embrace this particular idea, but how can you deny, and he goes on, he was given a script to read, remember
that? Oh, sure, that's obvious.
He was an actor sitting in front of a camera, and he was paid to read a script. These aren't his own words, they're written by somebody else for him.
He did it for Wines, what was it for Gallo Wines?
No, not Gallo, it was
some other wine.
Philippe somebody or other, I don't know.
Well, no.
We will drink no wine before it's time.
Exactly.
We'll bottle no wine or sell no wine before it's time.
I think it was Gallo or Petri.
It's time, let's drink it now.
So he was just a hired gun, or hired...
He was a hired actor.
A hired throat, a very good one, yeah.
But the interesting thing is he didn't understand that a couple of quatrains had been manufactured. Uh-huh. They took two lines from one, and two lines from one that was written years later, and stuck them together, and they came up with a prophecy where an earthquake was going to destroy Los Angeles, because it was made in Los Angeles, and they wanted to bring the local town in, you see.
Well, let's look at some of the quatrains, of which so much has been made by Nostradamian enthusiasts. For example, the quatrain that predicts the rise and dominance of Hitler, that predicts the whole Nazi era.
So they say. Now, those are not too difficult to solve, because there are three quatrains that mention, supposedly, Hitler. But we go back to the anagram thing now. They say that Nostradamus missed, that he got the word as Hister instead of Hitler, you see.
Close, though.
Two letters in it are transposed, and one of them is wrong, but close enough for government work. And after all, he did work for the government. Now, they say that Hister refers to Hitler. But in one of the quatrains, he clearly calls it the River Hister. And indeed, that's exactly what he was talking about, because later on, he talks about three towns that are in a little equilateral triangle, and they are on the actual River Hister, which was Latin for the Danube.
Uh-huh.
He was actually talking about a tributary of the Danube, which was known in his day as the Hister.
How does that whole quatrain run?
Oh, boy, I'd have to find it in the book here. You have it.
Your book, sir.
I could even refer to the original right here. That's a $12,000 book. Don't handle it too roughly.
All you've got to do is look up Hitler in your own
index.
Let
me see where I can find it here. I think we can come upon it almost immediately. No, not immediately, but close. And as he says, flipping through the pages of this wonderful book, which I hold right here, this map I drew, and it's almost accurate. Oh, here we are. he says, for one thing, all right, here's one of them that contains the Hister prediction. It says, beasts mad with hunger will swim across rivers. Most of the army will be against the Lower Danube. Now, he says history there. I call it the Lower Danube because that was the name that it was referring to. The great one shall be dragged in an iron cage when the child brother will observe nothing. Now, that last line is interesting, when the child brother will observe nothing, because in the original French, is quand rien enfant de Germain observera. Now, de Germain, Germain is spelled with a capital, and every modern interpreter has said that means of the Germans, you see. So what he's saying, when no infant of German origin or whatever will be watching. But what it really means, when the child brother will observe nothing, because de Germain in Provençal French at the time that he wrote that meant of the brother. It did not mean of Germany, because the French word for Germany, of course, is Allemand, and they had never used the word Germain until World War II, and they took that from the English reference to the Germans.
I was about to say, the word German is not used by Germans and is not used in any other language except English.
That's right.
To designate the people of Deutschland.
Exactly. So this obviously does not, they take the fact that it has Hister and Germain in it, and they say German and Hitler, so it's got to be an obvious connection.
Well, that's pretty sloppy work.
Of course it is, very sloppy work, but it suits the purpose of the interpreters, you see. They would rather have it this way because they're trying to make it fit.
Is it then your argument, sir, that all of the quatrains of Nostradamus are so ambiguous and so vague that you can make almost anything out of them to suit the occasion?
Absolutely, you can. As a matter of fact, I've got several examples in my book here where a single quatrain, for example, will be used by the experts, and you go to eight different experts, eight major experts, and they will say, oh, that obviously describes the Kennedy assassination. Another one will say, oh, no, that's Napoleon being sent off to Elba. A third one will say it's the Watergate scandal. It goes on and on like this.
Well, Nostradamus may have been a failed prophet or really a spurious prophet, but there are some real prophets, and I happen to know one. And he's offered me some poetic or quasi-poetic lines, which I think have great prophetic force, and I begin to sense that they tell us something about the recent past. He wrote these some 10 years ago.
Is that
ago.
What you have in your hand there?
And I'm about to read it to you.
Gee.
And then we're going to pause for some commercials, and I will hand this copy to you, and I will ask you to interpret what these somewhat veiled lines actually refer to. I read, coming through the illumined region, the image of the tumbling tower, inscribed yet lost, the great bear crashes into the golden pit.
Heavy.
Thrice flayed and twice betrayed, the cavalier turns his ear to Idnar in Notlim's house.
That's heavy stuff.
Well, I want you to take a look at it and see what it tends to suggest to you by way of interpretation. As I say, this was written some 10 years ago, and so it refers to events in our own history and perhaps some events yet to unfold in the history to come. We'll be right back to James Randi and his interpretation of a modern Nostradamus-like prophecy right after we pause. Can you predict, by the way, what's about to happen?
I get a word starting with C-O-M and a double M, as a matter of fact. E-R is followed by an S or a C, I'm not sure.
A C, I believe.
Close.
You're right, commercials, and then back to the amazing Randi.
How did I know?
We return now to this previously recorded edition of Extension 720. With your host, Milton Rosenberg.
I suppose I should reveal who actually is the source, Randi, of the prophetic lines I gave you. It's actually an Indian, that is an East Indian seer of my acquaintance, Ramadathanan Lal Ramarathanan, who occasionally does visit Chicago from his ashram up near Racine, Wisconsin.
He does upholstery repairs.
Well, on the side, yes. So, there you have it. I've given you a copy of it. Let's look at those and tell me, what might this have referred to? This came to Ramadathanan in about 10 years ago, and he wrote it down in a vision, as he does
after a bad pork chop.
All of his seer-like seizures. Mm-hmm. Coming through the illumined region, the image of the tumbling tower. Inscribed, yet lost, the great bear crashes into the golden pit. Thrice flayed and twice betrayed, the cavalier turns his ear to Idnar in Notlim's house.
Well, the second line fascinates me. Inscribed yet lost, the great bear crashes into the golden pit. Now, we know that in Moscow they have just opened up several American restaurants, the fast food chains. Now, golden pit would be a jar of mustard to me, of French's mustard, you see.
The golden arches, one thinks of, because the McDonald's
connection is obvious.
Opened their first
escapable, you see.
And the great bear,
of course,
is the Russian bear.
Russia. See how well this fits, you see?
Well, but how about this as an alternative? The great bear. A bear is somebody who bets on the market going down. And the market did, a few years ago, crash into the golden pit. Golden pit because as the market fell into decay, the
Donald
one
Trump.
Thing that increased in value was gold. When the market gets disrupted, gold increases in value.
How can I argue with that? I mean, that's pure logic.
Which of the two is being predicted here?
That's very hard to say. You see, it's like Woody Allen said, he did a discussion of a famous Greek prophet, and he said, this Greek prophet said that a short man will arise in France and will cause great consternation.
Napoleon.
Well, he said it could either refer to Napoleon or a midget named Marcel Ledoux, who was accused and then subsequently arrested for throwing béarnaise sauce on Voltaire. You see, so you have a choice of the two interpretations here. I wouldn't go for the Napoleon. I think the béarnaise sauce is much more applicable.
What else do you see?
Well, in the first line, coming through the illumined region would be brighter than dark, right?
I'm thinking
of a chessboard. I think of a chessboard with the white squares, you see, the image of the tumbling tower. Now, when you would take the tower, that is the rook, if you capture the rook, you just flick it off the board with your finger. See, that would be a tumbling tower right there, coming through the illumined region, you see, as it passes off the white square at the end of the board. I see a chess game here.
But that's not of historic significance. There are a million games of chess being played on any given day.
Who is one of the most famous chess players of all time, an historical character? Napoleon.
Yes.
You see, now, Napoleon did go to Russia, didn't he?
Oh.
And that's where he wet his Waterloo, yes. Met his Waterloo.
So that leads to the next line about the great bear crashing into the golden pit. But actually, it was Napoleon who crashed.
And Waterloo wasn't in Russia. But
Waterloo
was
in Russia.
Close enough.
But he did invade Russia.
Hey, we have to make a get to stretch.
It probably refers to both, don't you think?
Probably. I imagine both, yes.
What do you make of the last
thrice flayed, you see?
Thrice flayed and twice betrayed, the cavalier turns his ear to Idnar in Notlim's house.
Ah. I'm thinking of Van Gogh when I see that. He turns his ear. It could be turns his ear, could be slices his ear. It's almost the same word.
Yeah.
You see?
And thrice flayed and twice betrayed.
That's very true.
Gauguin
yes.
treated him badly. That was one betrayal.
That's right. Paul was a real fiend there. He tripped him once going out of the bar. I remember that distinctly. And then to Idnar and Notlim's house, that doesn't make any sense to me at all. I can't make anything out of that.
Well, here I've discovered something mysterious.
What?
Consider those two names. Mm-hmm. Look at them closely.
Idnar, I don't know. It doesn't mean a thing to me.
Well, if you read it backwards.
R-A-N-D-I. That's close enough.
Randy.
That's close enough.
And Notlim.
Who could Notlim be?
Read it backwards.
Smilton.
Well, there's a
I left out the apostrophe, yes,
yeah.
I should have.
Milton would. Oh, Idnar in Notlim's house means Randy in Milton's house.
You live here?
That means this moment.
You live here?
I don't quite watch, but...
I wonder what
the
hell
of a lot of time
for, but...
So this man had a prevision 10 years ago of your being here tonight.
Damn, that's incredible. Now, I have to believe that. There's no other way that I can possibly handle it. But you know, Milton, you can do this in a joking fashion.
I did it in about 10 minutes late this afternoon, of
believe
course.
Me, it's no better or worse than what you find in the authentic writings of Michel de Notre-Dame.
And what about more recent prophets and seers? The interesting thing about Nostradamus, he's interesting in and of himself, of course, and there are millions of people who believe in him, and there's still a great Nostradamian industry, I gather.
Mm-hmm.
But there are also lots of others who are prophets in our time, are there not?
That's right. And Gene Dixon, of course, is a name that comes to mind immediately as the most popular current modern prophet and also the most failed. In 1970, she made a wonderful statement. She said that there would be a huge asteroid crashing on the continental United States at a geographical location which she knew but would reveal, she said, quote, at a future time, unquote. Now, this is going to cause millions of deaths and fire, destruction, earthquakes, rain, the whole thing. It is now 1990, and my question is very simple. Gene, where the hell's the asteroid? Maybe it was very small. I didn't notice it in the Florida papers.
Well,
maybe in Chicago you noticed it.
Even Nostradamus occasionally made a mistake, I suppose. So she's entitled to a mistake or two. But remember, Gene Dixon predicted almost to the very day and almost to the very spelling of the name of the assassination of and the name of the assassin of John F. Kennedy. Did she not?
She said, first of all, when Kennedy expressed political aspirations, that he would never run for the position of president of the United States. Wrong, Gene. And after he announced that he would run, she said, well, he'll certainly never win. And then he won. She said, well, yes, that's true, but I'll tell you one thing. He will probably die while in office or shortly after leaving office. And Milton, she made that prediction based upon the 20-year cycle of presidents, which I'm sure you've discussed more than once.
But didn't she earlier, before Kennedy even ran for president, predict that a blue-eyed president would be assassinated?
Mm-hmm. That's very true. Yep.
Well,
she also said that the asteroid was going to fall on the United States. Now, which is more important, do you think? If I were under the asteroid, I think I'd move out, just grab the cat and run. No, forget the cat. I just run.
In other words, if you kind of splatter the world with a lot of predictions...
In a five-year period for the popular periodical, she made 364 predictions.
Uh-huh.
And a team of brother and sister team examined her predictions for that period of time. Out of 364 predictions, Milton, she got five right. Four, not even five. And one of the predictions was great medical breakthroughs this year. Wow, how did she know? That's what I call prophecy with a capital
P. I gather another very safe prediction is earthquake or cataclysm of some kind.
Oh, yes. If you look into Gene Dixon and all the rest of them, all of the great prophets of all time, starting with Nostradamus and going all the way back into the Bible, you will find that the most popular subject to be predicted is cataclysm of some kind, or catechism, for that matter. No, all kinds of disasters, every sort of disaster, floods, fires, earthquakes, assassinations, murders, wholesale plague and such.
Now it's time to draw the connection between this work of yours, and I think it's a superb book. I've really found it to be exceptionally well done, interesting, colorful, and revealing on every page. And I'm happy to say that my friend Peter Gorner, who's often been a guest on this program, said the very same in the Chicago Tribune only, I think, a week or, well, on August 29th, he said it. Indeed, let me just quote one paragraph from his review. The Mask of Nostradamus is an outstanding book, full and rich, a meticulous and thoughtful work of historical scholarship. Yet Randy keeps it exceptionally readable with not a single boring page. As usual, Peter Gorner is right. But
I'm very flattered by that, by the way.
No need to be flattered. He's telling the truth. But let's draw the connection between this work of yours and the various other things you've done and the various other matters you've often discussed with us in your many visits to this program. You, of course, I think it was probably your first published book, The Magic of Uri Geller, which you showed that Geller is a charlatan and a cheat or a conjurer who won't call it conjuring.
You said that. Now he can sue you.
Well, he probably will. I know he's been trying to sue you, but has failed. Your book, The Faith Healers, deals with overt intended fakery by people who pass themselves off Christian clergymen.
Purposeful lying and deceit,
which also helps to rush people to earlier death than they would otherwise
indeed
have.
Indeed it does.
And you've gone at astrology, you've gone at dowsing. In general, you are, of course, you got the MacArthur Genius Award, and they give those to some 20 people a year. You got it a number of years ago for your valuable social service in showing up this kind of fraudulence and chicanery as it tends to corrupt and confuse our lives. What's the connection between all of that and the work on Nostradamus and on prophecy?
Because, you know, the whole general theme behind this is, now we have four people sitting in the studio here that are members of the local skeptical group, and I know you're well connected as well, Milton. I would say that we'd probably all agree on this general observation, I would hope. When people say to you, and as they say to me quite frequently, what harm does it do if people believe in astrology or Nostradamus? Is it really going to lead to any harm?
It's an amusement.
It's an amusement. It's a light thing. People don't really take it that serious. The astrological column in the newspaper, any editor will tell you that you can take anything out of the newspaper, but not the astrology column or the phone goes off.
If Gene Dixon tells me that a two-headed child will be born to the wife of the prime minister of a country in the southern hemisphere sometime before the end of this century, it doesn't hurt.
No. What harm could that do? And the answer, I think, is very simple. The harm that this sort of thing does is it promotes belief in the paranormal, in the supernatural, in the occult, in absolutely illogical and irrational beliefs. And if people begin to live with those beliefs, suppose they go to an astrologer, an astrologer tells them something or other, it appears to come true, or they force it to come true in some way or another, the harm that it does is it gets them into a magical mode of thinking. And Milton, those people are going to vote, and they're going to make decisions for their children. They're going to know what school they're going to have to decide, what school to send the children to, how they're going to be educated, and by whom. And if they are thinking magically, they will go for that form of life. That is not logical, and it is not productive. It can be very, very dangerous. They will subscribe to the faith healers and the homeopathic medicine and the chiropractic and all this sort of thing, which essentially is useless and or harmful.
How harmful? We had a president recently whose wife seemed to take astrology rather seriously, and consulting with a friend in San Francisco, an astrologer.
How embarrassing.
She made some important determinations about her husband's traveling schedule.
Indeed.
Did that do any harm?
And she even timed an operation according to the configuration of the planets.
And Donald Regan, who revealed it all, sat in the chair you're sitting in now and carried on about it about 2 years ago.
And you know what he told me backstage in Washington? Came over to me, grabbed me by the hand. He says, I guess I owe you a bit of an apology. He said, you've been talking about this, they tell me, for 8 years on your lecture tour. And I said, yes, and no one has believed me. And he said, and after I published it and it became news and everyone was starting to talk about it, he said, members of Congress are coming to me and saying, Donald, didn't you know? We all knew that, but we didn't dare speak about it. It was an open secret in Washington, but it hadn't gotten to his ears yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I had heard it from many people in Washington, and I had been preaching it for 8 years.
All right, but go back to that. Did Nancy Reagan's belief in astrology and her controlling her husband's travel schedule somewhat on the basis of those special advisories she got from San Francisco, did that do any harm?
Possibly not, probably not. That's a very minor application of the whole thing.
And look, he got through his presidency without dying and without being killed.
That's very true. And
so maybe it did some good.
Oh,
forgive me for playing this role. That's the way the argument runs.
Of course. No, the point is that you don't know how well he would have survived. Hey, he might have done much better had he not gone for astrology. You look at a year ago this last June. On my TV special, we had an astrologer on there. Now, you know, I upped my $10,000 prize to $100,000. And this poor guy, he was the astrologer who was going to identify people's signs. If we gave him 12 people out of the audience, born under 12 different signs, by asking them personality questions like, do you prefer colored movies rather than black and white movies, this kind of thing? Are you a romantic kind of person? What is your favorite color, etc.? He would ask some questions like this, and he said that he would be able to assign 12 of them to the 12 zodiacal signs without any trouble. And we said, wait a minute, all you have to do is get 10. Then you'll be beating enormous odds, and you get the $100,000 prize. He said, oh, I can do it 12 times. I'm always successful at this. Well, the poor guy did it before the program, and we went on the air live, and he appeared there with his thumbs in his vest, you know, saying, hey, I got the $10,000 or the $100,000 prize. He had already bought new property and the new accordion and the whole thing, you know. And he made great plans to how to spend this money. And so the denouement of the thing was that we instructed him, the 12 people, okay, you've all been handed a slip of paper with the sign that you've been assigned to, the astrological sign. And we had 12 little booths there with the astrological sign over each one. Our instructions were, go and stand underneath the sign that you were assigned to by the astrologer. And they all went and stood there. The instruction was very simple. Now, thank goodness, the astrologer was facing away from the camera and towards the 12 people. And I was holding my breath because I knew that it wasn't going to work out for him. If you're under the wrong sign, step forward. 12 people stepped forward. And I was in a position where I could see the guy's face. Milton, it was just like you pulled the string out of the back of his head, you know. You whipped his spinal column out and threw it away. His face collapsed. His mouth not only dropped open, but everything in his face just sagged. It was astonishing to see. And I was hoping, don't get a picture of his face. The man will go and cut his throat immediately.
Of course.
But he made no excuses. I got to give him that.
What did he
made no excuses
he didn't,
afterwards.
He didn't rationalize
said,
it away.
I was wrong. Now, he may be making excuses now.
Uh-huh.
But in all fairness to the gentleman, I must say, A, he was brave to come on the program. B, he had the courage of his convictions. C, he was going to appear under his own name with his own face right on the screen there and try for the prize. And fourth, he didn't make any excuses afterwards.
But you walk into the office, and there's the secretary who's been there for some years and with whom you chat just about every time you pass her desk, and she's intelligent and is a family person.
Well-educated.
With some grown kids, well-educated. But every time you give her a chance, she tells you about... She pulls out today's horoscope from one or the other of the newspapers and says, look, it's exactly right.
It says here, don't drink poison today, and I haven't drunk it.
No, she says, I'm a Pisces, and this says, today is a day, or this is a period in which you should be careful about your financial investments, and there are some problems with relatives, but they're going to work out. And she says, that's exactly true of me, and she explains how it's exactly true.
Right. Well, let me tell you something. Do you know why the guy was wrong 12 times out of 12? I think he should have been right one time out of 12 by chance alone.
Yeah.
Why did he miss them all? Milton, he missed them all because he used astrology. That's how dependable it is. Because actually, you see, the astrologers put the onus on you. The burden is on you. They give you the horoscope, like stockbrokers, like the whole thing. They give you the interpretation. And unless you do the right thing with it, and or unless you make it apply to you, you're not being sensitive enough.
Well, you elaborate in the book, what is it, some eight or nine?
Eight rules.
Eight rules for prophecy.
Right.
They would apply just as well to cold reading, to doing astrology, to just about anything where you want to persuade the recipient of your wisdom that you've got some special purchase on deeper wisdom and deeper unseen truth.
You make them make it fit.
What are those rules? I think we should review them.
Okay, we should go over them. I have to look them up here because I don't know in what order I published them. Let me see. Where are the rules for... beautiful book, I tell you. Every time I look in this book, my heart just soars. Oh, here we are. I already turned to Rule 8. Okay. The Secret of Success is the name of the chapter. It says, Rule number 1, make lots of predictions and hope that some come true. If they do, point to them with pride. Ignore the others. That's a very good rule, mm-hmm. and it works. It always works. Rule number 2. I missed rule number 2 here. Where the hell? Oh, here we are. Be very vague and ambiguous. Define statements. Definite statements, pardon me, can be wrong, but possible items can always be reinterpreted. Always use modifiers like these wherever possible. These are examples of the modifiers. I feel that, and you make your statement, I see a picture of, it might be that perhaps look for, I'm getting an image of, you see, these expressions are not definite statements of fact or intention or prophecies, but they're things like, I get a picture in my mind of.
You know what I suddenly get a picture in my mind of? Good friend and great significant Chicago character, Harry Carey, who calls a home run the following way. It's well known to all Chicagoans. It could be, it might be, it is.
he zeroes in on it.
Yeah.
I see. Well, rule number 3, use a lot of symbolism. Be metaphorical, using images of animals, names, initials. They can be fitted to many situations by the believers. And that's very much what Nostradamus does. Mm-hmm. He refers to the leopard and the blue cloud in the sky.
And that's what I was imitating when I said the great bear crashes into the golden pit.
There you go. There you go. You've got it down pat.
Yeah.
I knew you could learn. Number 4, cover the situation both ways and select the winner as the real intent of your statement. Now, Jean Dixon is a perfect example of this sort of thing. She predicted in 1953 the death of a blue-eyed Democratic U.S. president elected in 1960. In 1956, she reiterated that whoever won the U.S. presidency in 1960 would be a Democrat, an expected result, who would be, quote, assassinated or die in office, but not necessarily in his first term. Then, late in 1960, she predicted that though she saw a young, blue-eyed, and brown-haired man as the next president, John Kennedy would not win that election. Now, that's a beautiful way of doing it. She's described him, she says, but that's not the person I see winning the election. And after she says, whoops, I was wrong about that, he did win the election, but I did get an accurate description of him. And rule number 5, credit God with your success. Nostradamus did that, she does it. They all do it.
The faith healers do the same, don't they?
Oh, indeed. And
the power is not mine, it comes to me from...
I don't heal you, God heals you. God. I just show you how to obtain God's healing. Mm. I lead you to it. So, credit God with your success.
And my wife leads me to it with the way in which she whispers in my ear and which I receive through
the little transmitter.
The famous Peter Popoff case.
Couldn't hurt. Which
you broke.
Couldn't hurt. Credit God with your success and blame yourself for any incorrect interpretations of his divine messages. This way, detractors have to fight God, not you, you see. And Jean Dixon always says that. If I misinterpret it, she says, then it's my misinterpretation of the image that God gave me. God was right, but, oh, silly me, mm-hmm. I got it wrong. Rule number six, no matter how often you're wrong, plow ahead. The believers won't notice your mistakes and will continue to follow your every word. Well, I've already illustrated that with Gene Dixon. Rule number seven, always predict catastrophes. They're more easily remembered and more popular by far. And if you look over any of the tabloid predictions, it's always disasters. You know, at one time, a friend of mine and myself in New York, we had sort of a little game that we played. We tried to invent headlines, front page headlines for the National Enquirer. Now, that was a lot of fun. I had one hands down with Liz Taylor will wed the Pope during an earthquake. You see, we figured that was as bizarre as it can get. But the following week, Milton, they came up with a headline, and I phoned this fellow up, and I said, okay, Pete, we got to give it up. There's no hope that we can beat this. And he said, what? And I read him the headline. He said, is that actually the headline? And I said, yep. And he said, I agree. We give up. End of contest. The headline was, psychic cures herpes by phone. Now, you can't invent a headline like that. Only the brains in Lantana, Florida, who run the National Enquirer, could possibly come up with that. One better than that, though, is man gives birth to himself. And, you know, that's reaching so far, however. I think they went over the edge with that one. The other one is just on the edge and teetering, you see. Anyway, rule number eight, when predicting after the fact, but representing that the prophecy preceded the event, be wrong just enough to be... appear to be uncertain about the exact details. Too good a prophecy is always suspect. And remember the Hinckley thing, where a man named Humley, Tamara Rand said, would try to assassinate President Reagan? Well, it turned out that was made about 48 hours after the assassination attempt. But I sent her a telegram at that time, by the way, and I said, Tamara, you got to get it straight. It's prediction first, followed by event, you see. The other way around is not fair.
But the press picked up and believed that. The press is quite gullible or culpable, or they just go along with the gag because it makes for a good reader.
That's right. Too ready to accept it because it's a good story at this moment, and we can't pass
it up. She faked the whole thing and wrote it down after the Hinckley attempt.
No, she made a videotape of it. It wasn't written out
Better
of a videotape
still,
that she purported as having been made 2 weeks before, and obviously it wasn't. Now, of course, you leave yourself open to all kinds of things. You've got to have videotape technicians there, the cameraman. All of these people can talk, and eventually they did, of course.
I'm very late for some commercials, but I want to put to you a query that I hope you'll respond to. I know you will after we take those commercials. Let's relate all that you've just been saying to other areas of prophecy which aren't quite as necromancical, which aren't quite as given to obvious charlatanry, whether by Gene Dixon or by Michel de Nostredame, namely to the financial gurus or the political gurus, Evans and Novak, say, or Bill Sapphire, or take your choice, or the weather forecasters. And there are yet other areas in which
Siskel and Ebert.
Siskel and Ebert? Well, are they predicting or just judging? I'm not sure.
No, I'm only putting you on with that. They're not mentioned in Nostradamus that I can find, by the way.
But let's talk about some of those and whether these same rules work for them just as they do for the Gene Dixons
the same techniques of
the world. Mm-hmm. We'll be right back to James Randi after we pause for these words.
You're listening to a previously recorded edition of Extension 720. The phone calls you hear are also recorded, so please do not call in during this program. Now back to your host, Milton Rosenberg.
And directly back to James Randi, the amazing, who is the author of what must be your sixth or seventh book, I suppose?
Seventh.
The Mask of Nostradamus, a biography of the world's most famous prophet that is published, by the way, by Scribner's, and it's been universally hailed and very enthusiastically reviewed, and should be available wherever they sell real books. The Mask of Nostradamus. Of course, this book is about a good deal. It's about Nostradamus, but it's about all the other things we've been talking about as well.
It is indeed, and I also had to go into detail, Milton, had to go into the history of 16th century France. I learned a lot.
Which you do wonderfully well.
And you have to do that in order to prepare the reader. You have to figure out, how is Nostradamus so popular today, 420 years after he died? You know,
Better than the competition. I learned from this, and I really didn't know that he was in a fairly crowded field. There were thousands of people doing the same sort of hustle.
Exactly. And he became very popular for a few sort of quirky reasons. First of all, he made the personal friendship of Catherine de' Medici, a very fierce lady, who really stood behind four consecutive kings of France, her husband, and then the three sons in turn, for whom she was regent in most cases. So she really ruled France for quite a period of time, a very powerful lady, and with somebody like that supporting you, you could do all right.
She also invented, or rather the cooks she brought from Italy invented French cuisine. That's the myth.
Indeed. What a contribution.
Well, it's true, but foodies that I know say it's not true at all.
Well, it may or may not be true, but we do know one thing. She instigated the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre of the Huguenots, and I don't think that makes up for French cuisine.
No,
it not quite.
Or French cuisine doesn't make up for it.
That's true. Yes, I'm sorry.
I want to instantly tell all who are listening that we've just opened the phone lines. The number is 591-7200, 591-7200. And if you want to pose a question or offer a thought, by all means, give us a ring right now. 591-7200. And please be patient. If you get a ring but don't get an immediate answer, let the thing keep ringing, and sooner or later, our producer, our overworked producer, will get to you.
She'll sober up and answer the phone, yes.
She's utterly sober, but at the moment, her hands are tied with a good deal of incoming material. 591-7200. Onto the phone shortly. So what about those other modes of prophecy? Financial. Various financial gurus have come through here. And they're famous for how well they call the market and how they help people get very, very rich until...
Yeah.
Joe, what's his name, was one very famous one. And then he had a great collapse about 2 weeks after he appeared on this program.
Ponzi.
Some years ago. Granville, Joe Granville.
Oh, yes?
Yeah. Though I gather he's once again become prophetic and is now heeded by some in his special universe of reference.
It's true, Milton. They use exactly the same techniques for the stock market, for the financial advice in general. If such and such happens, look for, you see, there's the phrases right out of my book, look for this, and I feel that, or an upturn can be expected if, and it goes on and on like this, what they're really doing is giving you all the facts, and then all the facts, they're outlining the situation and asking you to interpret what they're saying.
But there's another thing. Now we come to the possibility of the self-fulfilling prophecy, especially the self-fulfilling negative prophecy. If a financial seer says, as one or two did just before that great 500-point collapse of the market is in very unstable shape and shortly will take a real nosedive, therefore get out of equities and get rid of all of your stock holdings. There's one particular guy who said it very clearly about a week before the market fell. He got tremendous credit, and his seer status was instantly magnified by a factor of 10, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
But it's quite possible that he helped bring the collapse when it came.
Exactly, yes. Self-fulfilling prophecy. See, the effect of the prophet on the situation.
Yeah.
Now, Nostradamus in his day was really quite powerful because he was publishing these yearly almanacs. And the Farmer's Almanac of today is sort of the remnant of that version of astrological prognostication. And he, in his day, remember, Mary I of England had just died in 1555 at the time that he issued his first edition of the centuries, his set of prophetic quatrains. And Elizabeth I took the throne. And, of course, to help Henry II, his king in France, it was his duty, sort of, to help the king by prophesying that Elizabeth wasn't going to last. Well, she persisted for 70 years, and he was very cold in the grave by the time she was just getting accelerated there. She was possibly the greatest monarch that the British Union ever had, up to today even, and maybe ever will have in the way of monarchs, because I don't think that's going to last. That system's going to last very much longer. No, it's interesting. Of course, in those days, remember, the polls were pretty rough compared to what they are today.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a rather sophisticated operation now. But sophisticated or not, a poll is only sampling. You know, you're reaching into the barrel, you're taking a sample out. You've got to make sure it's
The interpretation there was that because everyone predicted the polls and all the journalists that Dewey would be elected, the Republicans let down on their campaign intensity. And so I thought they would coast in, and that, in fact, defeated them.
Might very well have been.
Continued to campaign vigorously, Dewey would have been more than the little man on the wedding cake.
Mm-hmm. there's no picture greater in political in political history than the picture of Truman holding aloft that newspaper.
That newspaper was the Chicago Tribune, you remember.
Is it?
Of course.
Really? I didn't read it. Yeah. I'm sorry. And remember Carlton Boyer's remark?
We still haven't heard from the farm areas.
Yeah, farm
areas,
yes. But, yeah. However... And
Truman imitating him.
Yes.
In a speech shortly after the
election. Yes. He spoke very much like this, I believe.
Yeah. Right. It occurred to me, and I've mentioned this to you before we started tonight, this fascinates me, but I don't know quite where to go with it, that in the area of professional life with which I've been associated for years, though I don't do what clinical psychologists or psychiatrists do, but I know a lot of them, as a different kind of psychologist, I know a lot of them, there's a good deal of prophecy. That is, the whole business of psychotherapy and of psychodiagnostics is to make predictions about how you're going to behave or what problems burden you and how they will affect your future behavior unless you take my predictions seriously and begin to follow my advice or follow my techniques so as to reverse or undo the fate that you now carry with you.
It's a technique for bringing about effects, and I can't really complain very much about that. You know, I don't think it professes to be predictive power or any such thing. I think it's a method of therapy, and it may work very well. You'd know more about that than I would.
Also a method of decision-making. If a guy's in prison for some kind of very bad behavior, suppose he's murdered in the past, if he's up for parole, you may well bring in a psychiatrist who will testify he's now profoundly altered as a person, and he's going to live a decent and sober and socially responsible life. That's a prediction. It's a prophecy about the future, and it will have some influence upon the parole board.
Well, remember another thing, that judges who release murderers and such are making their own prediction based upon their observations, and sometimes these people look at, who was it? Was it Dukakis who had released this?
Willie Horton.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Now, that was a judgment based upon the facts as he knew them and upon his interpretation of the character of the man, and he was wrong.
Of course, what we deal with here is the difference between prophecy and scientific prediction, or is that not really a difference that makes an absolute difference?
Oh, yes. It's, scientific would mean that it's based upon logic and rational thought. Now, a prediction is always made with a certain amount of certainty to it. You know that all scientific predictions are made with that kind of provision. With an accuracy of plus or minus 10 points or inches.
Well, it depends on how exact science is. Astronomy, you don't make those predictions with great inexactitude. You make them with great exactitude, and they come out.
You can say, however, that no
predict an eclipse saying it'll happen on such and such a day, give or take 3 days.
Yeah, indeed. And if they show the margin within which the prophecy should take place, that should be considered. It doesn't have to be right on the nose. They, of course, with it, take a thing like the eclipse. By the way, I went all the way to Helsinki, you know, for a bit of a holiday when they had the solar eclipse over there. Oh, God, talk about a sad story. We traveled several hundred miles north of Helsinki, right smack, right in the middle, with two experienced astronomers with me with my little Questar telescope, all the photographic equipment in the world.
And?
TWA managed to lose the whole thing for me, by the way. I never did find it. And here we are, right in the smack of the middle of the path of totality. We're there at 4 o'clock in the morning because the Finns don't know how to run an eclipse. They run it at the wrong time and everything. It's terrible. And the sun rises over the horizon. We're thrilled to death. We see a big bite taken out of the edge of it. Clouds move in. We don't see anything. But we did see the shadow travel across the opposite side of the sky.
But all the same, it happened when predicted. Whereas in some of the looser sciences, you don't expect.
And you know what the astrologers
accurate prediction.
The astrologers in Finland said that it would happen an hour later.
Oh, really?
And you know that nobody in the newspapers, though they published that prediction, bothered to go to the astrologer and say, "Hey, you were wrong. How come you were wrong?" No one bothered to follow up on it. What unnatural to be able to go to the astrologer and say, "How about your prediction being an hour off?"
Well, that's curious. Then that in a way undoes my point. You don't get exact precision in prediction, even in astronomy.
Even in astrology. No, the astrologers said that, not the astronomers.
Oh, the astrologers.
No, the astrologers said that. But watch my lips. No, the astrologers said that, of course, not the astronomers. The astronomers knew 100 years before, they knew to the exact
same thing.
I thought
so. That was my point.
No, that's a very, very accurate thing in astronomy, pardon me. Whoa.
Well, the gift to see the future is what we're talking about. And,
indeed,
of course, that's the ultimate dream of mankind.
Also, here's another thing that I point out in the book. Now, when I put that in the manuscript, my editor, dear Ned Chase, back in New York, who is Chevy Chase's father, by the way.
Oh, really?
Ned Chase really objected to a statement I made, and I said, events are not just sitting up ahead of us in the future. They're not there like points on a map or cities on a plan of some kind. They are not objects and things up ahead on the line of time that we are pursuing. And he said, everybody knows that. But everybody doesn't know that, Milton. I had to argue at quite some length with him that that's not obvious to everybody. People think that wars and deaths and everything are sitting up ahead in the future.
The radical motive of that statement would be the future doesn't exist.
Not yet.
Not yeah, something will happen later on. But
like people say, have you lived here all your life? Not yet. No, I haven't.
Or another way to put it is that... That's your Groucho Marx, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, brumpum.
Another way to put that is the future is made by our
only
expectations.
The possibilities are up ahead. There are an infinite number of possibilities up ahead. I know that my death is up ahead. I know that another eclipse of the sun is up ahead. But the eclipse of the sun, I can find out exactly when that's going to happen and in what locality.
Before we go to some commercials, then right onto the phones. Was Nostradamus a charlatan? Did he do all of this with tongue-in-cheek? Do most of them do it with tongue-in-cheek, or was he a believer in himself?
He was a charlatan to a certain extent. I do believe that he thought he probably could do it, but since we know that a lot of his quatrains were of the fourth kind, that is, quatrains made like Tamar Rand, he was writing in many of his quatrains of events that had already taken place several months before he wrote them, and he was hoping that future generations would look upon
them. So that makes him a charlatan. Process.
It does indeed.
Yeah. Like Tamar Rand and...
But he's not going to sue me because he's very dead.
One hopes.
I sincerely hope so, and I think I can predict that he's dead.
Yes, but you're one of those cynical fellows who doesn't believe
very
in
true.
Ghosts, doesn't believe in the karmic cycle of rebirth,
very
and so
true.
On. May well be your Nostradamus without your properly understanding.
Do you want to know that when I did my radio program, seriously,
yeah.
back in New York, back in the 60s, a man named Henry Roberts appeared on my program. He wrote one of the most popular books, it's still on all the bookstands, Henry Roberts on Nostradamus, in which he examined every one of the 944 quatrains. And poor Henry Roberts was a book dealer from the south part of New York City. He believed he was the reincarnation of Nostradamus. He appeared on my program with a man named Alan Abel, who was the famous hoaxer who created the Society for Indecency and Naked Animals.
Oh, yes.
Clothed all the squirrels and fish and the whole thing.
I remember that.
They were indecent.
Yeah.
And I agree with him. I mean, it's a terrible thing to see a naked horse.
Sacrilegious.
Yes.
It's gross.
And fundamentalists will agree with me, I'm sure. And he appeared with Alan Abel, and Alan Abel gave him such a hard time that Henry Roberts at the back of my studio started to have some sort of an asthma attack or something. They took him out of the place. He died in the lobby of the building downstairs. I killed Nostradamus.
Oh, my God.
Now, this is the first time I'm admitting it publicly. I killed Nostradamus if this guy really was the reincarnation. So I don't know in what incarnation I killed him. But the poor man
I think
actually
just revealed expired. Some of the unconscious determination of your decision to write this book.
Indeed, you got it.
Yeah. You're sort of justifying.
Exactly. I'm
what
to make
you
up
did
for it.
To Nostradamus in a later incarnation.
Indeed, yes.
And we'll be with you and your calls right after these words.
You're listening to a previously recorded edition of Extension 720. The phone calls you hear are also recorded, so please do not call in during this program. Now back to your host, Milton Rosenberg.
Our guest, the amazing Randy, the book that we've been drawing from is The Mask of Nostradamus, published by Scribner's, and we'll go directly to your calls. You are on the air. Good evening.
Hello. I'm very fascinated with the radio program tonight. I have a question regarding the Jewish biblical prophets,
uh-huh.
in particular Daniel and Isaiah, but especially Daniel in his eighth chapter, when he predicts Alexander the Great. And
can you give me the wording of that?
Let's see here. Therefore the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven, and out of one of them came forth a little horn, which waxed exceeding great, toward the south and toward the east and toward the pleasant land. And it waxed great even to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and of the stars to the ground and stamped upon them. Yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. And an host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression, and it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and prospered. Wait a minute, I'm getting into where it's talking about... Well, it says here, wait a minute. Then I heard one saint speaking, another saint said unto that certain saint which spake, how long shall the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of the desolation to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? And he said unto me, unto 2,300 days, and then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. I went too far. I read the wrong part of it. That one was supposed to be regarding Antiochus Epiphanes, and how his persecution of the Jews lasted for 2,200 days, the period from 171 B.C. to December 25th of 165 B.C.
About
Alexander the Great.
In the early part of what you read, we have is the reference to his conquest in the direction of the east and the south, and that's the direction in which Alexander went after he crossed the Hellespont and conquered Persia and went as far as the Indus River. So there's some rough congruence there.
I also read in the Antiquities of the Jews by Josephus,
mm-hmm.
that in there that book of Daniel was read to Alexander the Great,
uh-huh.
when he came into Jerusalem and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and now that's a very interesting point, Randy. There are in the biblical era and the post-biblical era, there are those who, in some sense, seem motivated to enact the prophecies that are already given.
Yeah, they think that they are the people who are named in these prophecies, and they try to fulfill them as best they can. But the interesting thing is that passage that the lady just read, a certain part of it, I have also heard, is supposed to have been the rise of Hitler and the Nazis in Europe, because some of the directions and the men of the horn is supposed to be the swastika. So again, we're faced with this same thing of interpretation. You can apply these things to many different historical events and events that are yet to take place.
Napoleon also marched south into Egypt at the beginning of his military career, and then east.
And then east into Russia.
Towards Russia.
Indeed.
Well, two more points then. What about where Isaiah named Cyrus in 200 years before Cyrus was to come to liberate them from Babylon?
And where does that occur?
I believe that's Isaiah chapter 45.
And do you know the wording of it?
In a minute, we'll have it, I'm sure.
Yes,
but perhaps a bit more briefly than the last one, Matt.
Sure, yes, I would prefer to be. This is what the Lord says to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I take hold of to subdue nations before him, and to strip kings of their armor, and to open doors before him so that the gates will not be shut. I will go before you and will level the mountains. I will break down the gates of bronze and cut through bars of iron. I will give you the treasures of darkness, riches stored in secret places, so that you may know that I am the Lord, the God of Israel, who summons you by name. And mm-hmm. From there it goes on, and it describes what he will do for that whole chapter.
What is the name Cyrus, by the way? I mean, to
Cyrus
whom does it apply?
The king of the Medo-Persians who conquered Babylon.
But it's the name of many different kings. There have been many Cyruses as kings. To which one of the Cyruses does it apply? Do you look through history, do you find the right Cyrus for it to apply and say, that's the one to whom it applies? What about the other Cyruses? Are they being neglected in this situation? You must understand,
Cyrus,
ma'am.
Was it a title, or was it are you saying that Cyrus was like a title, like Pharaoh was a title?
No, not necessarily. You should read some of the titles of some of these kings. They've got 30 and 40 names, great conqueror, this, that, and the other thing, Sam, George, Pierre, they have a list of names. Now, I'm not arguing the case with you. I'm just saying this is a good possibility. You must understand that these things can be applied many different ways, and somebody may come along right now, including Mr. Hussein, who's giving us so many problems in Iraq, and it may be shown that that exact prophecy could apply to him, too.
Our thanks to the caller. That does bring to mind, though, the kind of interpretation of biblical prophecy which you get from evangelical preachers.
Indeed.
Who find eschatological meaning, the end
yes.
of days. Undoubtedly, some of them right now are finding predictions in the prophetic books of the Bible.
Oh, yes.
Of the
yes.
Current Gulf crisis.
Absolutely, they are. Oh, yes. And whenever they get any mention of Arab or anything to do even with oil. And in the biblical days, they're not talking about oil under the ground. They're talking about oil such as olive oil and such. No. They'll seize upon that and they'll say, it mentions oil right here. It says oil. The word oil is written here.
But a few years ago, they were interpreting some of the prophetic words of the Bible to predict the inevitable nuclear war between us and the Soviet Union.
Indeed. And they were also using some of the quatrains of Nostradamus that I hear explaining Hussein to explain Khomeini.
Mm-hmm.
And the hostage situation in Iran. It's incredible that all of these things can be applied age after age. And I know that some other Arab force is going to come to light in the next 20 years to which these same quatrains and same biblical passages...
They must have applied them also to Colonel Gaddafi at some point.
Oh, indeed, Gaddafi, in a book by John Hogue that I discuss in my book at great length, with more errors in it than you can count. I mean, I just hit some of the tops of the mountains as I went by and just snickered them off there. As I mentioned the book, he mentions Gaddafi all over the place. He's in Nostradamus everywhere, and yet those same quatrains are now being used today by some of the people in France to explain the Kuwait invasion.
Let's go to the next caller. You are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening.
Yes, sir.
I unfortunately do not remember the name of the man, but there was a monk who predicted the popes.
St. Malachy.
Okay. And he used a symbolism that very often showed up as part of their shield.
Yeah, well, to make it a little more correct, I almost mentioned him in the book, but I ended up leaving him out of the Nostradamus book because I didn't think the prophecies were all that great, for one thing. St. Malachy is supposed to have left the prophecies of St. Malachy's at a certain monastery someplace, I believe in Greece or something, if I remember correctly. And the actual vintage of those prophecies is not very clear, even those that support them. And I've seen several books, a book written by a friend of mine in France with whom I disagree on most things, except that French wine is excellent, almost as good as Gallo in some cases. And this man, in doing his research on the thing, pointed out that it doesn't have to apply to the coat of arms and or the motto of the Pope. It can also apply to the coat of arms of the town in which the Pope is born.
It was a generality, but
yeah.
they say that very often it did show up and that he did predict the correct popes during the time of the anti-popes.
Yes, indeed.
And the interesting thing is that he is down to his last one, isn't he?
Yes, I believe that, and I've forgotten, I hope that you could refresh my memory on that, something like the next pope is supposed to be the last one, or there will be two more popes after this one?
If not the last one, at least the last one he predicted.
Yeah. Yes, he says that the whole thing ends after that, I believe.
So what do you make of this?
Of it is, again, the wishful thinking, because some of the predictions of these popes are things like leader of the flock. Well, any pope is a leader of the flock. Another will say something like a gold shield. Well, most of the coats of arms do have gold shields or silver shields in them, or shields of some kind.
Not the corpulent Bishop of Venice to become John the 23rd.
No, not anything quite as good as that. That I would have to accept, you know. That would be as good as you could possibly get in the prediction field.
So the same quality of ambiguity.
And same quality of ambiguity, yes, yes. And it's a great, great leader of the masses or something.
Mm.
And, you know, and then they'll say, but this pope really did lead the masses. Well, they all did, of course.
And for the current one, he didn't say a pope shall come out of the East.
No, he didn't say anything
or something
there,
like
no,
that.
Or out of Poland. No,
yeah.
No.
Here's the next caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, my question is, if, in fact, you can't predict the future, you have to assume that the future exists out there and that it cannot be changed.
Right.
And if that's true, then why would anybody like Nostradamus bother to even publish any predictions? Because you can't change anything. All you're going to do maybe is upset people if you can predict things like wars and conflagrations and things
That. Well, I don't think he worried whether he upset people as long as he was selling his almanacs. See, the interesting thing is that the church in Nostradamus' day did condemn astrology, and for a very interesting reason. The church of the day, and certainly today even, can't accept astrology because astrology would say, though they have now modified their sayings to the effect that astrology impels, does not compel, but it would mean effectively that the future of each person is written in the stars and the configuration of the planets and stars at the moment of his birth.
You know, it occurs to me there, let me thank that caller for a useful query, that an area we've really neglected is prediction, prophecy about the future when pointed to the individual life. The reading of your future that you get from the expert in palmistry or the lady with the the crystal ball or whatever, or the one who predicts you from your handwriting or something of the sort.
Mm-hmm.
What's the usual? You've probably played those games yourself. You do some fine cold readings in which you persuade people that you see deep into their characters, but then you also fool around with the future. Do the same techniques apply to futuristic prediction of individual lives?
Oh, absolutely, yes. You've got to give generalities. You've got to say, watch out for it.
Predict my future over the next year or so.
Something like that. I see a distinct improvement in your health, Milton. Though you're in good health now, I think that you're going to come upon therapy shortly. And when I say therapy, it could even be the application of a simple vitamin pill or something like that, or a change of diet, perhaps an avoidance of cholesterol foods, which I notice you're very careful with, and for good reason. But I think there are going to be changes made in your life that you're going to get advice from someone who appears on this very program, which may... Do you understand what I'm doing?
Okay. You're kind of covering all bets.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. All the possibilities are there.
You're also suggesting something positive. What if you were going to deal with some negative predictions?
Oh, well, the negative predictions you've got to be very careful of, though. You don't want to disappoint anybody. You say, watch out for, and it would be well to guard against, or I get an image of, there's a cloud here. There's a cloud. There's a darkness over one side of your head. And, of course, that could be over your hearing, over your ears. It could be you could lose hair on that side of your head. I see a darkness is a very popular way of doing that. But this darkness can be dispelled, you see, and you've got to give some sort of hope follow-up.
Of course, there's an art to doing this so that you can persuade the person who's bought your services that you called everything. You know, the person you meet at the cocktail party who says, you may be a skeptic, but I went to this fortune teller and she had everything.
She told me things that she couldn't possibly have
known. And she predicted exactly what happened to me later on.
Yes, indeed. But you've got to remember that the report of the event is not often very congruent with the event, because in many cases I've had tape recordings of what was actually said, and it doesn't agree with what they relate to you afterwards.
What if it's, she said I would meet a guy, a buck-tooth guy with one bad eye,
named
and
George.
I would fall in love with him and I'd marry him,
yes,
and I did.
And he then we had two children who were named Mark and George or whatever.
How do you handle something like that?
No, I don't. That's too good. Although it may be the self-fulfilling prophecy again. You know, I was making a point, which I really should get back to if you'll forgive me, Milt, why the church was so much against astrology.
Mm-hmm.
Because it meant that man had no free will. And if man doesn't have free will, sin doesn't exist, because it's already written in the stars that he's going to sin.
Well, it doesn't necessarily work out that way, because after all, man has no free will in Calvinism. Not really.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly his post-natural destiny is predetermined, is predestined.
Mm-hmm.
But by the signs of grace, the good person, the one who is destined for heaven, will necessarily live a good and moral life. God wouldn't be so inconsistent as to have him live a bad life and then take him to heaven.
But if you don't have free will, you don't have sin. If you don't have sin, you don't have a need for the church. And that's one reason that the Catholic Church feared the Calvinists so much.
Mm-hmm.
And in the days of Nostradamus, we have only touched briefly upon what the real mask of Nostradamus was. He was living with a mask over his face, and that was something which I discovered. I have to go back a bit, if I may. I went to the Bibliothèque Nationale, the famous library, the marvelous library in Paris, where everybody hates you, all the clerks and everything. Until they find out that you're really serious, and then they embrace you, and they do anything for you, including fetching coffee. And I made some good friends here at the Bibliothèque Nationale, and I found in their index a most interesting set of documents, 53 letters in the original Latin, the original letters now, not just copies of them, from Nostradamus and to Nostradamus from his clients. And I thought, this is a gold mine, because I've never even heard of this before. Now, you must understand that all major libraries like that have marvelous documents on hand that are buried in the archives someplace, and they list them, but nobody's really looked at them. They just list the fact, we have these. Well, I applied to see them, and the librarian, the head librarian, was most embarrassed by the fact that they didn't have them there, that they were in Switzerland, he said, being authenticated and translated into modern French. And I said, well, when will they be back? And he said, oh, two and a half years. And I thought, uh-oh, I got a deadline, and Scribner's not going to wait that long for the book. So I thought I had to do without them. By serendipity, or synchronicity, or whatever you want to call it, Milt, I had just turned in the manuscript to the publisher. Now, at that point, they don't want to hear from you again, right? You can't make any changes, right? So I was in Baton Rouge in Louisiana at the university there, a lovely place and great town. I was lecturing there, and I had 3 or 4 hours to spend. And a couple of the students were squaring me around and said, what would you like to see? I said, I'd like to see your library. Went to the library, picked up Nostradamus on the computer. It came out with Lettres and Edite, unedited letters. And it said there are 53 letters in Latin. I said, what? This document couldn't be here. I asked for it. It turned out to be printed in Switzerland, a very thin volume. The French translation had been published in Switzerland, and I hadn't even known about it. I immediately photocopied the whole book, and we found out the real mask of Nostradamus.
Which was?
That he was a Lutheran. Now, his family had converted 2 generations before from Judaism. Remember that he was under suspicion by everybody because they'd say, once a Jew, always a Jew. That's a suspicious family down the street. No, you know, you got to be careful of them. They're probably practicing black magic and Kabbalism and all that sort of thing. The Kabbal was something that was really, really feared in those days. That was worse than being a Calvinist or a Lutheran. And so he was always under suspicion. It turned out that the man was actually a Lutheran sympathizer, and on the same day, he writes 2 letters. One is written to his friend in Metz, Germany, and he says to this man, he says, these damned papists, pardon the expression, but he referred to them that way, these damned papists are burning people at the stake merely for their beliefs. On the same day, he writes another letter to the cousin of the Pope, saying, would you thank His Holiness on my behalf for helping to rid Provence of these terrible heretics? And he is one of the heretics.
So the secret is, so he wasn't a secret Jew, he was a secret Lutheran.
That's right.
Yeah. And that's the mask of
Nostradamus. That is the mask of Nostradamus. He was living, this man, under the shadow of the Inquisition.
I rush to commercials necessarily, but before I do, you surely you have noted that this odd coincidence of your finding the lettre en édité in Baton Rouge represents a strange destiny moving through your life.
A miracle of a semi-religious nature, I would say.
Don't you think it is? Doesn't it suggest something beyond the normal?
It's called dumb luck. That's what it's called.
Which is beyond the normal, perhaps.
Indeed.
We'll be right back to James Randi after this.
You're listening to a previously recorded edition of Extension 720. The phone calls you hear are also recorded, so please do not call in during this program. Now back to your host, Milton Rosenberg.
James Randi, our guest tonight. This must be your 10th or 12th appearance on this program.
Easily.
You really ought to move to Chicago so we can do this more often. The book we've been drawing from, subtitle, A Biography of the World's Most Famous Prophet. Title, The Mask of Nostradamus. And just published by Scribner's. We go right back to the phones. Here is the next caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Dr. Rosenberg?
Yes, sir.
This is kind of spooky. When I tuned in tonight, I thought you were interviewing Lowell Thomas, the traveling commentator, and that's kind of amazing
what?
In itself.
What made you think that?
Well, Mr. Randy's vocal quality is very similar to Lowell Thomas's, it seems to me.
Well, I remember Lowell Thomas, who's been dead perhaps for the last 15 years.
Right.
Who knows? Maybe he is. Maybe there's some interpenetration of essences here.
I did a book tour with Lowell one time. As a matter
did
of
you?
Fact. Fascinating guy. Yeah, very, very irascible, though. Very short-tempered. He hated everybody who was buying his books, but he signed them anyway.
Well, my question is, why is it that so many of us reach for the most sensational, romantic, magical interpretation of any event or phenomenon? Was it Santa Claus or early training or something like that?
I think that you may have the secret right there, but I also think it's because people like magical explanations much better than they like perfectly ordinary explanations.
Uh-huh.
They want a little more romance in their life, a little more excitement, and that's a thing that the skeptical movement has to rail against and has to take criticism for, because people will say, why are you taking the fun out of my life? And I think the reason is, again, that falling into that magical mode of thinking can be very damaging, very, very negative in anyone's life. Unfortunately, I've always said, look, nature just doesn't give a damn about you. Nature doesn't care. You got to learn to survive one way or the other. It's called survival of the fittest, and by golly, it works.
Right.
Thank you, sir, for the call.
Thank you.
Of course, another way of putting all of that is that an aspiration that you share with some of the other leading skeptics, and one might mention Martin Gardner, Paul Kurtz,
Isaac Asimov,
Phil Klass, and so on. Indeed, the guys who whom you drew together to found the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of the Claims of the Paranormal, PSYCOP, which is, I think, a very significant presence. I'm happy to be a late member, that is, more later than that, invited to join the board of that organization.
Indeed.
What you all share, and I certainly share this with you, is an aspiration that man achieve his best in terms of rationality. We can't be totally rational and rational all the time, but to avoid mystery mongering and avoid all the regressive modes of simple, unlimited symbolization, which distorts reality.
It's really medieval thinking.
But is that aspiration, in fact, realizable? It really is taking the method of science and the aspirations of science and saying they ought to be able to guide daily cognitive process as well. Can it really be done?
As long as you're brave enough, Milton. It takes a certain amount of bravery to face up to the fact that nature doesn't care. Again, doesn't give a damn about you. You've got to survive in spite of the odds. And if you don't, you're one of those that falls by the wayside. That's the way the world is. There's nothing really terrible about that. It leads to a stronger species. Now, I may sound very cruel and callous. I'm the first guy to take the puppy dog as the runt and give him a chance. I'm the first guy to help the guy who's been hit by the car and everything. I put my folded coat under his head, and I've done it on two occasions in my life. And I don't care if he bleeds on it, but he needs an advantage. I'm not going to leave him behind. I'm not going to be part of that mechanism if I can possibly help it, but I realize that it works. And I'm willing to go when my time comes to make room for younger and more exciting people. It's maybe hard to explain. People will say, how can you face up to dissolution and everything with no magic in your life? I got a lot of magic in my life. And looking into that puppy dog's face is magic enough for me.
It's interesting, the direction you just took in your answer to my question. What you really are invoking is the hypothesis that our lives and all the magic and mystery and mystical confusion we build into them are really designed to exert one special necessary function, namely the denial of death.
Exactly. Denial of death is the one big mistake that mankind has been making. Animals don't have to do it because perhaps they don't have a realization. I think they probably don't have a realization of their own inevitable death. They see it around them, but I don't think they connect it with their own demise. But the denial of death is the one thing that has really held us back from being brave enough to really face the world on its own terms and make the best of it while we're here this once.
Well said, but provocative, and it's curious. There is a theme in modern intellectual life. It goes by various names. It's post-structuralism, deconstructionism, and so on, which denies all the order of scientific thought and says that it too is just a way, is compounded of a web of words and is an illusion behind which one finds meaninglessness.
And I think that's because whoever would embrace that doesn't understand what science really is about. Science is not a set of rules. Science is not a religion. It's not even a philosophy. Science is a search. It is a search for truth about the world around us, subject at all points in its development and in its declarations to correction upon the submission of better evidence. S equals UT plus half AT squared. Isaac Newton came up with that. That describes cannonballs being dropped off the Leaning Tower of Pisa, for example. Works very well. Cannonballs aren't subject to a great deal of friction from the air. It works quite well. Okay. But then along comes Einstein and says, wait a minute, when you get down very small, subatomic and such, and very large, into the galaxies and nebulas, it doesn't work. That doesn't mean that Newton was wrong, because in the theory of relativity, that formula is embedded somewhere along the way. Newton wasn't wrong, he just didn't have a wide enough spectrum. Science is glorious in that it is subject to correction at all times. It's a search.
But all the necromancers and mystery mongers, whether they're prophets or seers or whether they are specialists in clairvoyance and psychokinesis, or whether they are astrologers or whatever, they get such a large public and such easy acceptance because, yes, they help us deny death, but also they give us very simple accounts of major forces which explain a hell of a lot of the variance around us, a hell of a lot of the blooming, what otherwise comes through as blooming, buzzing confusion.
But that's also some of the beauty of mankind. Our particular species is always looking for answers. We look for patterns in everything from snowflakes.
Not only are we fearful of death, we are intolerant of ambiguity.
That's right. And we want to have answers to all of our questions. And it's very hard to accept the fact, I just haven't got all the answers. That doesn't mean there aren't any answers or that they can't be arrived at. I just haven't got them at this moment. I have to be satisfied with that. I don't like it, but I have to be satisfied with it.
Let's go back to the phones. Here's the next caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, good evening. I wanted to ask Randy, having heard him a number of times on your program, I assume that your criticism of the irrationality and so forth would extend to all the major religions, then. And any believer of any of the major religions you would be critical of, all of which are based at bottom on some faith or some belief that's not subject to empirical verification. It's not subject to scientific inquiry. Christianity, Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, all of these things you would be critical of. And somehow, having heard you over a number of times, I can't conceive of the amazing Randy devoutly going into church and praying to his God on Sunday. It's just not your bag, is it?
And you're right.
You know, I mean, it's just... And do you carry that criticism across the board to all the major faith groups, then?
Well, let's first of all, let's look at what we can do logically. You've already pointed it out. Religion is not subject to examination by scientific means, unless you come upon something like the Shroud of Turin, which by a certain proportion of the public was a matter of religious faith, certainly not officially of the Roman Catholic Church, the Vatican, ever. They've always denied that they ever said that it was the Shroud of Christ, etc., or that it was even a holy object, until just recently, when the decision was made that it was from the 13th century and couldn't possibly have been the true Shroud of Christ, if there ever was such a thing. Now, I don't criticize religion because I can't examine it. I merely say it's an unproven case. If people prefer to believe that God is a cabbage, lives in their garden, glows at night, and speaks French, fine. They can invite me around to see this wonderful cabbage, and I can judge whether or not it really is a god. But unless they offer me some evidence that I can examine, I don't criticize their beliefs.
The caller asks you and not me, and I'm going to horn in for just a moment, which I really shouldn't do. But it seems to me one can have this whole skeptical orientation that you represent so well and so forcibly, or forcefully and so effectively, and still entertain the idea that God is a reasonable hypothesis. You can't buy perhaps the particularities of any given religious tradition, but through theological reasoning of a sort, and through one's own experience and the mysteries that one encounters, one can postulate the possibility of a superordinate and eternal order of reality to which one may or may not want to take a worshipful relationship, but which nevertheless one can assume to be there. And one can even appreciate the particular symbol systems of of the established faiths for their attempt to approximate that kind of truth and give it some kind of coherent representation so that you can relate to whatever is beyond.
I'm sure the amazing Randy would say, Milt, that's utter nonsense.
Well, let's see what he says.
He's too polite to say it.
No.
He's never been polite to me. We're too good. We've been friends too long. Am I speaking utter nonsense as you hear it?
Not utter nonsense, Milt, but I don't share that particular
aspect. Yeah, I know that we disagree on that.
I would say this, that if God is ever discovered, if there is a God and God is ever discovered, God will turn out to be a very great set of truths, and it will be the order of the universe, the basic order and basic laws of the universe. Mm-hmm. And I don't find that too unlike what I could envision a God as being. I don't think of a bearded figure sitting on a throne someplace straight up above me.
No, nor do I, of course.
And I don't think most people do. Well, maybe most people do, but I don't think a lot of people do that. But I don't have any need of a God, a creator, a spirit, that kind of thing, in order to have a satisfactory grasp, I think, of the world around me. That doesn't mean I understand the universe or all the secrets of life. And again, I have to be content with not understanding them, and I refuse to invent an entity in order that I can say it's all ascribed to God.
Let's thank the caller. Thank you for a most valuable question, sir, and we pause for a last round of commercials.
We return now to this previously recorded edition of Extension 720 with your host, Milton Rosenberg.
And right back to James Randi. You are on the air. Good evening.
Hi. I was wondering if Randi has heard. My fiance lives in Southern Illinois, and she talked to me on the phone, and she said, she read this article out of the newspaper to me, and it was a climatologist apparently predicted the San Francisco earthquake shortly before it happened. And at the same time that he predicted that, he said that on this coming December 3rd, there would be an earthquake either on the New Madrid Fault down in Missouri or in Tokyo. And as a geologist, I was kind of perturbed that a climatologist would be predicting earthquakes. And I'm a member of MCRI, too, so I was very skeptical of him predicting a specific date for an earthquake. I was wondering if Randy has heard anything about that?
No, I haven't. I'm edified by it. But I would ask you, if you're a geologist, did I get that correctly? You are a geologist?
Yeah.
Any idea how many actual earthquakes occur?
Well, he was predicting a big one, like a disaster-sized earthquake. I mean, earthquakes, earthquakes happen every day in both of those areas.
Well, an average of something like 50 earthquakes a day occur someplace on Earth, not major by any means, something like 8 major ones a year. So that's not a bad prediction. December 3rd, huh?
Yeah, he predicted, well, it was December 3rd or 4th or something like that.
Gee, I'm going to go in on the 2nd and start buying property, yeah.
And either in the Midwest or in Tokyo. That's sort of hedging your bets, too, isn't it?
And the article, I didn't have anything as to what his reasoning was behind this earthquake prediction.
Well, I would be interested in knowing just how many people predicted earthquakes for every day of the 6 or 8 months in San Francisco before it occurred, because obviously just about every day somebody predicted it, and eventually when it occurs, I got lucky, I got the lottery, the earthquake lottery, I got right, of course. It's like plane crashes. Every major airline around the United States and around the world receives predictions almost every day of somebody saying, one of your planes is going to go down, I just got a vision.
Interestingly, that's why, though, they got forewarning of that dreadful thing over Lockerbie, Scotland. They didn't act upon it because Pan Am said they get such warnings from intelligence services just about every day.
And from cranks who call
and
say, I put a bomb on the plane kind of thing. What kind of a world are we living in, man? You know, just when I went through airport security today, I thought to myself, geez, we used to walk on the plane. And you'd have a shopping bag in your hand, you'd walk on the plane. Nobody ever bothered to ask you if you got a bomb in there.
Well, them days are gone forever.
I guess so.
Most of the good things are gone forever.
Yeah.
Let's work in one more quick call. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, I'd like to ask Mr. Randy what his opinion is of the so-called sleeping prophet, Edgar Cayce.
Oh, boy.
Well, I have a chapter on him in one of my other books, Flim Flam.
He's in Flim Flam, right.
Yes, I recommend it to you. He was known as the Sleeping Prophet. I headed that chapter, The Slipping Prophet, because it shows that Mr. Cayce didn't really do too well on his prophecies, particularly when he did a thing like the Lindbergh kidnapping.
Yeah.
But his major style was medical diagnosis at a distance while in a somnambulant state.
Yeah. He seemed so sincere.
Yeah, I think he probably was sincere, but like anything else, his followers, as with Nostradamus, his followers did more for him after he had died.
Did he have the same quality of vagueness and hedging his bets?
I have a quotation from him in my book, Flim Flam, and it goes something like, unless this case, as of said today, but not forthwith and heretofore, were a case of, and I do not say this with any reservation, although the reservation entered at this point in time could, if it would, and it goes on and on like this, it doesn't make any more sense than Nostradamus.
Well, I take it he wasn't too accurate in any of his predictions.
No, not quite. Didn't work out too well.
No, I see California's still there.
Yes, indeed, and the books on his predictions have now pretty well vanished from the shelves because most of them are already supposed to have taken place, and they didn't.
Uh-oh. Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you, ma'am, for the call. I see one here I want to get to. It's going to only have about a minute or so, but go ahead, please. Are you there?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
I was fascinated by your interpretation of the Hitler comments by Nostradamus.
It's Hitler.
I was wondering if you have an alternate interpretation of his references to Pasteur.
No, he says pastor. He doesn't say pasteur. Well, the French word pasteur, of course. But it means pastor, P-A-S-T-O-R, or it has several different meanings, I mean, keeper of sheep, all that sort of thing. And it doesn't necessarily have to refer to Louis Pasteur. Somebody has to have the name Pasteur along the
way.
What
does he do in that quatrain?
I don't recall, to tell you the truth, and I wish I had it at hand so I could tell the gentleman about it, but it has a quite mundane explanation.
Well,
I'm sorry, I have it
at hand here.
Yeah, you can do it in just a few seconds, sir. Go ahead.
Say, the lost thing is discovered, hidden for many centuries. Pasteur will be celebrated almost as a godlike figure. This is when the moon completes her great cycle. Mm-hmm. But by other rumors, he shall be dishonored.
I see. It doesn't say pastor, though. It says the pastor. You left out one word. The pastor, mm-hmm. not pastor. That,
right.
that could make a lot of difference. It could be a name in that case, or it could mean the pastor. We're running out of time, I'm afraid.
I'm afraid so, too. And, of course, if you search through all of the quatrains, you're going to find some that you can do something with.
Indeed.
That's
the principle. That's the idea.
That's the basic mm-hmm. principle.
You betcha.
But tell me, O seer, with half a minute left, what are your predictions for, say, the next 10 years, and we're approaching the millennium?
Well, Nixon will not make a comeback. The end of the world will not occur in 1999, as Nostradamus would have us believe, with the great, the king of the Mongols is going to come back? I don't think so, unless that's Hussein. And let's hope we get out of Iraq. I'm sick of that situation.
I'm looking for something vague and glamorous.
Okay, the leopard shall appear in the sky.
That's
the cloud, the blue turbaned one, and it goes on and on.
I'll look for him. And I'll look for you to come back soon. James Randi has been our guest. The book we've been drawing from, the last of his very valuable works, The Mask of Nostradamus.
The last or the most recent?
The most recent. By no means the last. Good heavens, how could I do that? As a matter of fact, I predict about 10 more within the next 10 years.
Thank you.
And this current book published by Scribner's, thanks very much, Old Amazing, and thanks to all for listening. And we return tomorrow night at 9.